I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As New York braces for next Monday's Republican National Convention, an activist group and the city of New York face off in a courtroom in downtown Manhattan today over what could be the largest demonstration in New York's history. The group, United for Peace and Justice, wants to hold a protest this Sunday that could attract up to 250,000 people. And they're requesting a permit to march from Madison Square Garden to the city's famed Central Park. The city won't issue that permit, saying the protest will destroy the $18 million refurbished Great Lawn in Central Park. Well, yesterday, courts ruled against two smaller groups also requesting the right to rally in Central Park. And joining us on the line from New York is Bob Wing. He's national co-chair for the group United for Peace and Justice. Bob, the city says they spent millions between 95 and 97 to restore this Great Lawn, and they're willing to close down the West Side Highway for you instead. Why isn't that good enough?
Well, the main problem with the West Side Highway is that we found out that to hold a large rally like we're planning on that site would cost at least $300,000 to get a sound system that could project that far. The problem is that the West Side Highway is fairly narrow. Mm. So for that many people to be in that kind of space, for any significant number of them to be heard, we would have to spend $300,000 for a sound system. That just doesn't make – we don't have that kind of money. That's tantamount to saying we really can't rally.
Well, what is your group doing today in court? We know you're calling witnesses. Who?
We're in court today with our second attempt to get permits in Central Park. But, you know, the thing that I need to say first mm-hmm. is I want everyone to know that we do have a permit for the march. We have a legal permit from the city to assemble at 7th Avenue and 14th Street starting at 10 a.m.
Right. What's in question is where you end up. What's in question is where you end up, whether or not you can go to the park.
That's right. So that what we also, though, the other part that is also agreed to now is, as you said, we get to march up 7th Avenue to Madison Square Garden, which is where the convention will be held the next day. So that part is perfectly legal and worked out. What you said is true. Mm-hmm. What remains to be worked out is where we will end up and whether we'll have a rally. We're quite confident that we will work these things out ahead of time.
Well, now the city further says there's no rain date, as there couldn't be, you know, because you're locked into this date, and many concerts have a rain date and so that mud wouldn't further destroy the area. They say that you struck a deal for the West Side Highway weeks ago and recently backed out of that deal, and that your group puts up no bond, which other groups have to do. We only have about a minute left. Your response?
That's not true. I want to say a couple things. As I said, the West Side Highway, we did have to back out because we found out, as I said, the cost was prohibitive.
Right.
We are willing to try to put up a bond, and we've also made suggestions for several other sites, not only within Central Park, but throughout New York. And they've refused to negotiate on any of those other things. They basically have said the West Side Highway or nothing.
Well, what will you do if you lose? Will you encourage your perhaps thousands of followers to protest anyway or to go to the park anyway?
We're going to do everything we can to keep people legal and safe. The leaders of this march, United for Peace and Justice, are not going to lead the people into anything illegal.
Okay, well,
so we're going to be negotiating down to the last second if necessary. Hopefully the courts will rule in our behalf, or if not, we'll negotiate something ahead of time. But we are going to negotiate something that will keep people as safe as possible.
Bob Wing, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Wing, national co-chair for the group United for Peace and Justice. Well, vote early and often. That was the rallying cry coined in the city of Chicago in the 1800s. And it turns out that thousands of voters are still taking this highly illegal action to heart. They're voting in two states during national elections. Investigative reporter Russ Buettner broke this story for the New York Daily News. Russ, give us the numbers. What did you find?
We matched up the voter registrations from New York City to Florida and found 46,000 people are registered in both places. And of that, it's very difficult to figure out how many of them have voted in both places for one election, but at least 400 to 1,000 of those people have done that.
That's astonishing. 46,000 people have registered in both New York and Florida. Now, I know you met some of them. What do they tell you about that?
Most of the people I spoke to have homes in both places. We call them snowbirds here in the Northeast, and that they registered in both places because they were uncertain where they were going to be when the elections rolled around.
Well, let's address that first, because that is illegal. You're not supposed to be able to register in two states. How is it possible that you do?
Well, it's voter registration works mostly on the honor system. You're required to list on the voter registration forms in both states if you the address where you've last been registered to vote. And then if you do that, that kicks in a notification process to the other jurisdiction. If you fail to do that or don't do that because you still have that other residence, there is no notification system, and you remain registered in both places.
As we said, you met many of these double voters. Tell us about 84-year-old Norman Siegel.
Well, I called Norman on the phone at his Florida home, and I started walking through why I was calling, that I was looking into people who were registered to vote in both Florida and New York City. And he interrupted me and said, "That's illegal. You can't do that. You have to pick one place or the other," which was an interesting thing to hear from a man who was registered in both places. So I told him the record showed he was registered in both places. And he said, "But I haven't used that one." And it was unclear to me which one he was referring to. So I asked him that, and he said first Florida and then New York. And I said, "Actually, the records show you have voted in both places seven times since 1988. And at that point, he said, "I have to go. I have to go." And he hung up the phone, and that was the end of our conversation.
Well, I know, too, you spoke to an Irving Hertz in Brooklyn who also responded in much the same way. What did he say?
Irving said, "I'm not here today." And he hung up. He and his wife have voted five times between the two of them in both states.
When you talk to a lot of these people, we understand that a lot of them were confused and weren't doing it purposefully. Some of them felt that, in fact, it was ensuring their vote. They thought they could send in an absentee from one state and vote in the other state. And if one of them registered, it would cancel the other?
It was close to that. I talked to a few people who thought that they had mailed in their absentee ballot in one state too late and thought it wouldn't be counted. And so they went ahead and went to the polls in the other place on election day. I talked to one person who thought he was pretty close to the deadline, but he had no faith in his vote being counted in Florida, so he decided he would damn the torpedoes and go ahead and vote in New York anyway.
Did you find that this was mostly the elderly? I mean, mostly the elderly are snowbirds, the ones who fly south for the winter, but is it mostly the elderly who are making this, and is it genuinely a mistake, or did you uncover what you thought might be corruption?
I have no evidence that there's been any kind of organized effort to do anything like this. I would suspect most of it is innocent, but there's really no way to know. I think the important point is that it sort of reveals an Achilles heel of the entire system, that there's no way to check for people who are registered in both places, and there's absolutely no checking after elections of people who may have voted in both places.
Mm. Norman Siegel, who you mentioned, who had voted twice in seven elections, is a Republican. But what was the breakdown of the double voters that you found in terms of numbers?
Of the people who are registered in both places, about 68% were Democrats and 12% were Republicans. Among the people who appear to have voted in both places, the breakdown was even between Republicans and Democrats, pretty close.
We know the penalties are stiff for double voting. You could get 5 years in prison. You could get a $10,000 fine. Have election officials said anything to you? Are they going to go after any of the people that you spoke with?
Reaction's not been maybe what you would expect. They're not going to look into this in any wholesale way. They're not going to try and duplicate what we did. What the officials in both states have decided to do is to just take action on the five people who we named solely as examples who have voted in both places. I think that's a little bit disturbing in itself.
Yeah. No wonder Irv said, "I'm not here."
Right. Good point.
Russell Buettner, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Russ Buettner, investigative reporter for the New York Daily News. For more on his article about double voting, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, joining us now is Alan Lichtman. He's professor of history at American University in Washington. Professor, this is an unprecedented. In 2002, the Washington Post found 10,000 voters double registered. They were in both D.C. and Maryland. And we can understand how, say, an elderly person might do this, but how, again, does the system allow it?
Because we have a decentralized system. Each individual state sets up its own voting and election procedures, and then those procedures are usually administered by individual counties within the state. Florida and New York do not share voting information, and indeed I think it would be a grave mistake to try to match voting lists across states and exclude people whose names allegedly were found in both places. We saw what a disaster it was when Florida tried to do name matching to exclude felons from voting. It was perhaps even politically manipulated because the lists were very heavily biased against Democrats and Hispanics in Florida, who are very heavily Republican, were almost entirely absent from the list.
This happened in the 2000 election. Is someone claiming that it's happening again?
Absolutely, it happened again in Florida in 2004. The list was so flawed in 2004, the state withdrew it.
What do you see as some other issues that are still in the air that are problems in voting? I'm taking a look at the new ballot in Florida. Voters are now going to be asked to connect broken arrows to select a candidate. This is instead of the butterfly ballot of 2000. What do you think?
I think ballot design is a huge problem. The problem in Florida last time came not just from obsolete voting technology, the punch card technology, but as you say, from complicated and difficult ballots. Ballot design was one of the highest predictors of error rate in Florida, and there could be problems again. And of course, there is enormous controversy over the use of new electronic touchscreen voting, which will be used by nearly 50 million voters. There is possible hacking that could be done to create fraud. There is controversy over whether the local officials responsible for administering these machines will have them programmed properly. And there are many around the country clamoring for a paper trail. And the only place you have a paper trail is in the small state of Nevada.
Well, and we're reading today that New Mexico, which prides itself on its electronic voting, is now finding that 678 votes went uncounted in the 2000 election.
Right. And that was because apparently of local programming errors. Look, the truth is, in a human process, you can never eliminate all errors. And there's a big trade-off. On the one hand, do you want to do things like crack down on possible double voting in New York and California? Or on the other hand, do you want to make voting as accessible as possible, recognizing there may be some slippage? My own view is you come down on making voting as accessible as possible. We could talk forever about these glitches, but the huge unspoken voting problem in America is over 100 million eligible voters don't even bother to vote. We have approximately 50% adult turnout in presidential elections and under 40% adult turnout in midterm congressional elections. We are almost dead last among the industrialized democracies of the world, and we've been stuck at the 50% mark now for a generation. That's the real tragedy. That's the real problem that should be addressed.
A far bigger problem than a handful of, 90-year-olds voting twice.
Precisely so.
Alan Lichtman, thank you.
My pleasure.
Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University. He spoke to us from Washington. Just ahead, we review breakthroughs in the business world, hear the next big thing before it gets big. And later, did Army medics play a role in the abuse at Abu Ghraib? There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Each year, the Harvard Business Review publishes a collection of essays about trends in the business world. This year's issue came out in February, and we spoke back then with editor Tom Stewart about some of the breakthrough ideas. He told us the ideas that made the issue were the kind that kept people up at night, either with fear or excitement. We asked him to begin by explaining one, the stupid money syndrome.
Whenever there's a fad of any kind, there's always a whole lot of lemmings chasing after an ever-diminishing pile of cash. The dot-com bust was a classic example of it, and now there's a very interesting example of it involving German tax shelters and Hollywood movies.
Mm-hmm.
Wealthy German citizens, have a real incentive to try to find ways to shelter their income. And one of the ways that they do it is they collect a lot of money and invest it in vehicles that invest in Hollywood movies. Something like $2 billion in 2003 and $8 billion in the last half a dozen years.
Often in very bad movies.
Often in The Fast and the Furious, and Terminator 3, if I may even say
yes.
the words.
Yes, no, you may. And so this explains a lot of bad movies, but what does it do to the industry?
Well, you know, it does all kinds of things to the industry. First of all, Hollywood for years has always been very good at finding sucker money. I mean, they live and die off of that. So they what it does is it inflates the prices. I mean, it inflates these guys. If you come to them and say, I've got $100 million I'd like you to waste, they're really good at it. You're probably going to see some stupid money investing in nanotechnology over the next few years. And when nanotechnology looks like the next big thing, go for something bigger.
Beware. Okay. Let's take a look at some of the other. Again, these are the more quirky entries. There are some far more serious in nature. But you have something you call the, well, we're going to, for our purposes, we're going to call it the no jerks policy. You use another word, which I'm imagining has never before appeared in your publication.
That's true. It's the first time the word has ever appeared in the publication. It is an anatomical word to describe a certain kind of boorish, arrogant, obnoxious personality that is all too familiar to all too many of us in the workplace. And there's a wonderful article that we have here by a professor at Stanford named Bob Sutton, a wonderful guy and a good friend of mine, who talks about the value of companies having a no-jerks policy, an absolutely explicit policy saying you cannot behave that way around here. We're not going to hire you if you, you know, demean people. We're going to fire you if you yell at your assistant or are rude to other people. We are just not going to have this kind of person working around our shop. It ain't worth it.
Why is it better for business? Why is it a good idea?
Well, you know, more and more of business actually does involve collaboration, especially when you're looking at, you know, high knowledge activities where people are, where teams of specialists have to get together. When you have that kind of overbearing, impossible to work with person, he or she just completely interferes with teamwork. It just messes things up completely.
Is it policy anywhere?
It is. Actually, there are a couple of law firms, one in Chicago, a law firm named McDermott, Will and Emery, and I think this is probably very important for law firms. Another one, a Phoenix law firm named Snell and Wilmer. Both of these have very explicit policies saying they will simply not tolerate this kind of behavior. They won't hire people who act that way, and they'll drum them out if they do.
Okay, on to another column. Tell us what your finding is about the breakthrough idea concerning Prozac.
Well, there's an interesting and not particularly attractive fad, or the beginnings of a fad going on. It's called cosmetic psychopharmacology. And the indications are that there are people out there in the business world, people with whom you may be negotiating, people with whom you may be working, who are taking Prozac or other antidepressants simply as a way of performing better, not because they've been prescribed for any true psychiatric or psychological condition, but sort of the same way a baseball player might take anabolic steroids because boost performance.
Is that what it does? Is that proven?
Well, you know, it is demonstrated. People know that these SSRIs, as they call selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, actually do level out mood swings. They help you control your anger. They might make you a better negotiator. And in fact, there was a study that was made that showed that some people who were taking a drug called Paxil performed better in negotiations, probably because they were less at the mercy of their own emotions and were able to negotiate in a more relaxed and calm manner.
You are so together. I'm tempted to ask, are you on it right now?
No, but I'm drinking some really nice tea that is provided here.
Well, what are you at the Harvard Business Review feel about this as a breakthrough idea?
I think it's actually a little bit odd. I think it betokens something else, too. I think it betokens how people might, in a time when jobs are under threat, when they are under stress, might reach for anything to give them that little performance edge, even at the cost of their long-term health.
Before we let you go, we've talked about some of the quirkier ideas, but just tick off one that strikes you that's, you know, would be more front of the burner in management school.
One of the mainstream ideas in this collection comes from Clay Christensen, who is a professor at Harvard Business School, who we asked Clay if he could come up with something that he suspected was true but could not yet prove through research. And he came up with this idea that he calls the law of the conservation of attractive profits. And the basic idea is that when industries change through technology or something like that, and profit disappears from one part of an industry. Say the profit goes out of the PC business. He suspects that that profit pops up somewhere else in that industry, sort of like a whack-a-mole theory. If you knock it down someplace, it's going to pop up somewhere else.
Like it went from mainframe to PC.
Well, or like it might go from from mainframe to services, or it might go from PC to internet connections. Whatever it is, along this value chain, if you squeeze the profit somewhere, it's liable to pop up somewhere else. And it's a very interesting thing, first of all, from the point of view of a manager, because if you see that your business is becoming commoditized, as the jargon goes, then maybe adjacent, or just a couple of steps down or up the chain, there's some attractive profits that you can get at. And it's also something that people should think about as investors. If you see that the profit margins in a company that you've invested in are disappearing, take a look at who their customers are, or take a look at who their suppliers are. There may be somewhere, someone along that value chain who's reaping the profits that are being taken away from the place where you've got your money.
Tom, thank you so much.
Robin, thank you.
Editor Tom Stewart of the Harvard Business Review. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, do Americans trust their leaders? We take a look at the role of trust in the political process. And what happens when politics collides with the Olympics? The Iraqi soccer team is not happy being mentioned in a Bush campaign ad. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. There is much to report today regarding the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. A deal has been struck with one of five U.S. Army reservists facing hearings in Germany accused of abusing Iraqi prisoners. A lawyer for Staff Sergeant Chip Frederick says prosecutors will drop some of their charges if Frederick pleads guilty to others. Prosecutors also said today that two U.S. military intelligence soldiers will soon be charged in the Abu Ghraib scandal. It will be the first time members of the intelligence community have been charged. The judge presiding over the pretrial hearings rejected a request for testimony from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, saying he needs more evidence that the testimony would be relevant. And the New York Times reports that a high-level investigation into military detention facilities, led by former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, concludes that leadership failures at the highest levels of the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and military command in Iraq contributed to the abuse. A second investigation, led by Major General George Fay, is also expected to be released soon. It is expected to condemn the military leadership that allowed the abuse to take place. Well, Dr. Stephen Miles, an American physician, is calling for another type of investigation into the role of military medics in the abuse. His article in this week's Lancet magazine charges that medics enabled the abuse by improperly reporting injuries, collaborating with abusive guards, and delivering substandard care. He joins us on the line from Minnesota. And Dr. Miles, let's start with your response to the Fay Report, which reportedly condemns doctors for remaining silent.
Right. The Fay Report did look at the question of whether or not physicians were silent in terms of reporting abuses, and it appears that they were silent.
Well, silent would be the least of the charges that you make in your article. Let's turn to those. You were not in Iraq. First of all, how did you come to the conclusions you did?
There are about 3,000 pages of government documents that have been released. I've looked at those 3,000 pages for medical information. I also looked at reports by respected organizations such as the Red Cross. and also extremely well-documented press reports where they were able to use named sources or identified documents. I did not use anonymous source documents.
So you feel pretty confident about your information?
I think that even the Pentagon is not denying the truth of the allegations.
And what are some of them?
Well, there were a set of problems. First, the military system had an obligation to not deprive detainees of an adequate health care system. There was a policy decision made that physicians should approve interrogation plans and monitor interrogations, and it appeared that they did so. Medical records were given to interrogators to use in developing interrogation plans. That would include confidential information that would be useful in exploiting patients' fears or conditions.
What would be an example of that?
Well, for example, if a medical record said that this person had three sons, an interrogator might say, "We know where your sons are. Why don't you cooperate?"
And those records were given to the interrogators by the physicians?
They were given to the interrogators by the commanding officer at Guantanamo, and he stated that it was a routine practice to make those available.
Mm. In other cases that you cite, medics and doctors were complicit in some of the torture.
A medic actually, in one instance, gave a guard a suture kit in order to suture up a laceration that the guard himself had inflicted. That guard was not medically trained. In another instance, a prisoner collapsed, clutching his chest during a beating. A medic came, revived the prisoner, and then instead of taking him away to an infirmary, as he should have done, left that person in the hands of the guards who continued the beating. There was also an effort to cover up torture-related injuries and deaths.
Yeah. How else were medics or physicians actually complicit in torture, probably the most disturbing accusation?
Well, covering up is a part of being complicit because, obviously, to the extent that torture is concealed, torture can proceed. And death certificates were falsified. Medical reports did not include injuries. And in one case, a corpse had an IV put into it to make it appear that the person had been alive.
You write that military personnel treating prisoners of war, you know, doctors and medics, face a dual loyalty conflict. What is that, and how did that get addressed at Abu Ghraib?
Well, essentially, there is a difference between being a doctor in the military and being a soldier. And when that difference gets lost, then patients' human rights are, in fact, endangered. And that's why the UN says that a doctor's responsibility is to the well-being of the detainees. Somehow that broke down, and that's the essence of what the problem is.
We understand from your article that one policy empowered interrogators to evaluate and refuse the request of a person under interrogation for medical evaluation.
That's correct.
Is a medic supposed to be in the presence of that interrogation?
Well, interrogation should not be a medical procedure that requires medical care in order to perform it. Interrogation is a questioning. And one of the issues here is that when you do hazardous interrogation, it becomes a medical procedure, but that does not mean that medics have any role in participating in it.
And what are you saying? Should they? Should there be a policy change?
No, there shouldn't be a policy change because in a profound way, medics and physicians are the first line of defense against torture, and their independent oversight, both from professional codes of ethics, international law, and indeed United States law, is important to preventing these types of abuses. We are all served by these. When our soldiers become POWs, we want these standards to be enforced. When important dissidents, like, for example, the woman who is leading the fight for democracy in Burma, is imprisoned, we want these standards to be enforced. When journalists are imprisoned, we want these standards. And so when the system of international law breaks down, as it has here, all of us are endangered.
Doctor, what happened to the doctors at Abu Ghraib? What happened to the actual doctors in the field? How could they have done some of these things?
Well, war is a stressful environment, and that's why we have rules of conduct in order to try and etch bright lines in the conduct of war. And indeed, it is very hard to maintain these standards, but a prison is not the same thing as a battlefield. And so it's a place where discipline and command responsibility can be exercised. There was also a deep failure to educate the medical personnel with regard to their human rights responsibilities.
Have you heard from Army doctors after your piece in The Lancet?
As a matter of fact, three military medical personnel have spoken to me, and all three have said that I've got the story about right, which is very sad.
Stephen Miles, a physician with the Center of Bioethics at the University of Minnesota, his article titled Abu Ghraib, Its Legacy for Military Medicine, appeared in The Lancet magazine. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, elves, dragons, and hobbits galore, we head to the new Lord of the Rings Museum exhibit. You're listening to Here and Now. A condiment used to sweeten foods and found in cupboards around the country may actually also be good for your health. Recently, Gail Harris spoke to Here and Now's health columnist Judy Foreman about the benefits of cinnamon.
For one thing, it tastes good. So if you think of it as a drug, it's probably the best-tasting drug in your medicine cabinet. Basically, if you sprinkle a quarter of a teaspoon of cinnamon on your food a couple times a day, that's a total of about 1 gram, and that seems to be enough to lower your blood sugar and lower your cholesterol, which is quite amazing for just a little spice.
And what inspired someone to figure this out or to study it?
Well, there's this guy named Richard Anderson at the USDA, the Agriculture Department in Washington, and he's been interested in this for years. And he did a study in Pakistan, actually, of people with type 2 diabetes, which, as you know, is rampant in this country, too. And it was a carefully done study, and he found that the people who were taking cinnamon actually were able to lower their blood sugar and lower their cholesterol. And this wasn't true when people were not taking cinnamon.
And was he able to ascertain how cinnamon works?
Yes, at least for diabetes. It's very intricate biochemistry, but basically cinnamon kind of acts like insulin. Insulin is the hormone that helps get sugar into cells. And cinnamon has an ingredient in it that I won't even bother to try to pronounce that acts the same way as insulin inside a cell. It basically starts the chemical reaction whereby cells metabolize sugar. So it is essentially very much like insulin. So when you're taking cinnamon, you're essentially taking insulin.
Well, does that mean then that you should stop taking cholesterol-lowering drugs or insulin or whatever else you may be on and have cinnamon instead?
Not exactly. It does mean that if you're a diabetic and you're taking insulin already and you start taking cinnamon as well, you should monitor your blood sugar extra carefully because you may be sort of getting a double dose. So you should and tell your doctor about it too. But for cholesterol, there's less data, but no one is recommending that you rely on cinnamon instead of the statin drugs, which 20 million Americans take to lower cholesterol. It's probably not as strong, and it's certainly not as well studied as the statin drugs. So, don't give up what you're already taking. But keep track. If you're adding cinnamon to your diet and your next cholesterol test is lower than the one before and that's the only change you made, it may be doing some good.
Will they be doing more studies about this?
Yes, they will. And there are extracts in the works that will have sort of the water-soluble pieces of cinnamon available for people who want that instead of just sprinkling cinnamon on their cereal.
And in the meantime, I guess this doesn't mean we can all go eat our weight in cinnamon buns, does it?
No, unfortunately.
Too bad.
Yes, this is not supposed to be an excuse to just, go to Cinnabon all the time and or even have, lots of cinnamon cookies. But just sprinkling a little bit on your cereal or using a cinnamon stick in your coffee, that should work.
Well, it certainly sounds good, Judy. But is there enough data to start using cinnamon the way you're suggesting?
The data is still coming in. It's very preliminary. But yes, since it's so safe at small doses, I would say yes.
And once again, define little bit?
Little bit is a quarter of a teaspoon twice a day.
Here and Now health columnist Judy Foreman. To read her column on cinnamon, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I want to live with a cinnamon girl. I can be happy rest of my life with a cinnamon girl.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. First, there were the books, J.R.R. Tolkien's three masterpieces that comprise his epic Lord of the Rings trilogy. They told the story of a magical ring of power created by the evil Lord Sauron and the struggle to destroy the ring before it destroyed Middle-earth, home to hobbits, dwarves, elves, and man. Well, then the books became a hugely successful series of films, and now they are an exhibit. At Boston's Museum of Science, museumgoers have a chance to see The Ring, find out how the films were created, and how it feels to be in one. There's even a place where you can have your picture taken as a hobbit. Well, Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa made a trip to find out more.
My name is Ed Rodley. I'm a content developer at the museum here, and I was the exhibit planner.
Why an exhibit like this at the Museum of Science?
Well, this is largely an exhibit about movie-making technology, and the Lord of the Rings trilogy is really a milestone in movie-making technology.
What about people who say, oh my gosh, you're taking all the magic away from the movie?
None of the magic is lost. If anything, being able to get this close to the stuff really gives you an appreciation for them that you don't have seeing them on screen. And when you're inches away from, especially some of the handcrafted stuff, like the costumes and the armor, and you see the level of detail they put into the work, it's really breathtaking.
My name is Michael Drought, professor of English at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts. I'm also the editor of the journal Tolkien Studies and of the J.R.R. Tolkien Encyclopedia.
So here we are in a Tolkien exhibit. What attracts your attention first?
Well, there's this enormous display of all the different armor, and right away you can see that they were trying to come up with different styles to characterize the different kind of cultures. Tolkien has multiple cultures in Middle-earth that are all interacting with each other. So you have the evil orcs, and you notice their armor's all kind of spiky and ugly and unattractive looking, and then the tall, noble, almost Greek looking warriors of Gondor, and the Anglo-Saxon looking armor of Rohan.
What can men do against such reckless hate?
Ride out with me. Ride out and meet them.
For death and glory.
For Rohan. For your people.
Ed, what are we seeing now?
Right now we're in front of an interactive that talks about 3D scanning technology, which is how they created a lot of the models that were used in the film. Even though even the models that you wind up seeing as computer graphics almost all started off life as real clay maquettes, real models, because it's faster and easier to, you know, for an artist to mold something out of clay than it is to tell a computer animator to, you know, make me a cave troll that's got, you know, the level of detail necessary to make it look realistic.
Okay, so you start with a clay model, mm-hmm. you scan it, and then you can play with it in computer. Is that what you're telling me?
Right. So if you imagine, you know, imagine Peter Jackson and the rest of the people sitting down at the beginning of the film saying, all right, well, what do we want a cave troll to look like? And, you know, the artist will be sitting there furiously sketching, and like, oh, we'll make the head a little bigger. Well, make him a little taller, make him a little broader, give him, you know, four fingers instead of five fingers. All those sorts of things are easy to change. You know, you crumple up the paper, you start again, or you pull the finger off the model and you smooth it out a little bit. Whereas if you're doing it on a computer, it's all, you know, you're working at a level of abstraction from the thing, so it's a lot harder and a lot slower to do that.
Michael, I have to ask you, you know, you've read these books so many times. You must have had some sort of image of the orcs or the Uruk-hai, and now we're standing here in front of a model of one. What do you think?
Well, it doesn't match my image, but I'm not troubled by that. A lot of people were saying, oh, if you see the image, then you'll never have your own. I have my own image, but I can't draw or create it on a computer, so I have to rely on other people who have those skills. And it certainly does what it needs to do, which is be really, really scary and horrifying looking, which is kind of the point of the orcs.
Do you know how the orcs first came to being? They were elves once. Taken by the dark powers, tortured and mutilated, a ruined and terrible form of life. And now, perfected,
Uruk-hai.
Okay, we talked about some of the bad stuff. Now we have some of the good characters as well.
Gandalf the Grey Wizard, the prime mover in the entire plot. In Tolkien's view, Gandalf's job was to kindle the hearts of all the various scattered and weakened good guys and bring them together and to convince them of the seriousness of the fight that they had ahead of them, and also to convince them that it was worth fighting, that you couldn't give up. And over here you have, I guess, Gandalf's personal effects. And one of those things is the Red Ring Narya, which is the Ring of Fire. There are three elven rings. These are good rings.
Right. Actually, the poem that ends in the poem that culminates around the ring talks about nine rings, three rings.
There's three rings for the elven kings under the sky, seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone, nine for mortal men doomed to die, and one for the dark lord on his dark throne.
In the land of Mordor, in the fires of Mount Doom, the Dark Lord Sauron forged in secret a master ring to control all others. And into this ring he poured his cruelty, his malice, and his will to dominate all life.
Can you describe to me what we're seeing?
I believe we're supposed to be inside the Samath Naur, which is the chamber in the heart of the volcano, Mount Doom, where Sauron forged the One Ring, the Master Ring. And there it is right in front of us, kind of suspended in space and glowing with inner fire around it. And it's written on the ring, one ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them. It's written in elvish script, but it's supposed to be in Sauron's own evil language called the Black Speech, and it's Ash Nazg Durbataluk, Ash Nazg Gimbatul, Ash Nazg Thrakataluk, Ag Burzam Ishi Krimpatul. And that's the One Ring to Rule Them All poem.
And this is really what everyone's been fighting for throughout the entire movie, really.
Yes, everyone wants the ring because the ring can give you absolute power. But the ring, because it is absolute power, creates absolute evil. So Tolkien's great gimmick was that, unlike in Wagner or any of the other previous stories with a magical ring, instead of the quest being to get the ring for yourself, the real quest was to destroy the ring, to remove this source of power and temptation from the world. It's an incredibly modern vision in an incredibly medieval milieu.
The ring cannot be destroyed by any craft that we here possess. The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade. It must be taken deep into Mordor and cast back into the fiery chasm from whence it came. One of you must do this.
What is it about Tolkien? I mean, the movies were hugely successful. What is it about Tolkien that really appeals to people? Ed?
I think just the sheer scope of the vision. I mean, I can't remember any film in recent history that has done such a good job of making you feel like you were somewhere completely new and different, that you've never been before. You know, just in terms of being exposed to an entire world with realistic, you know, peoples and landscapes and cultures. You know, nothing has ever come close to what they have done with the Lord of the Rings films.
Michael?
I think Tolkien has an integrity and a consistency of vision that very few other fantasy authors can match. And I think the biggest thing is, when Tolkien was writing this, he was not writing it for a market. He wasn't sure he could sell it. He didn't think it was going to be accepted. He was just writing it to develop his world more. And because of that integrity of vision, that's one step away from, you know, building a toothpick sculpture of the Statue of Liberty in your garage. He was just one step on the side of this artistic vision, and it worked. And he took such enormous risks, and it all came together.
Ed Rodley, content developer at the Museum of Science, and Michael Drought, editor of the journal Tolkien Studies, speaking to Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa. The Museum of Science exhibit, The Lord of the Rings Motion Picture Trilogy, The Exhibition, runs through October 24th. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.